Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Later this week, the West Coast poet Dana Gioia makes the cross-country trek from California to the nation's capital, where he's being considered as the next head of the National Endowment for the Arts. Gioia is one poet who won't have trouble with the double Windsor knot in his necktie. He comes from the Wallace Stevens tradition of business executive come poet, having logged many hours at a desk for General Foods. When Gioia takes his seat before a Senate subcommittee and someone asks for his curriculum vitae, they might hear that the poet's father drove a taxi, that his mother ran a soda fountain, and that Dana Gioia went on to study literature at Harvard. Or when they ask for his curriculum vitae, they might get this, a poem from his latest collection. Curriculum vitae. The future shrinks whether the past is well or badly spent. We shape our lives, although their forms are never what we meant. And Dana Gioia would probably be the first to say that the form of a job in Washington as head of the NEA is never what he meant. But what about it, Connection listeners? Is an artist the best person to be in charge of government policy for the arts? Dana Gioia once asked the question, can poetry matter? Assume for the sake of this show that the answer to that is a resounding yes. Let's talk about why. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us from public radio station KRCB in Sonoma County, California, is the poet, Dana Gioia. Welcome to The Connection.
Good to be here.
So am I safe in assuming that the form of a job at the NEA is perhaps never what you meant?
Well, I have to say that looking at my life, most of it wasn't what I originally intended. One simply, goes where life or fate leads one.
So, did you apply for the job or did they come after you?
Well, to be honest, not only did I not apply for chairman of the NEA, when I was first approached about the job, I told them that I wasn't really interested. I got a call from White House personnel, and apparently they had gone around the country asking people who would be a good candidate for the job. And they were talking actually to a great many people. And when they phoned me, I told them I wasn't interested. And they said, well, why not? I said, well, I'm not a political person. And the NEA has been an agency that's been a highly politicized agency over the last 10, 15 years. And I just don't see myself operating in that world. And secondly, I'm a writer. There's so many books I want to write, so many projects I want to undertake. And at the moment, I'm just working on all these different things. I just can't see myself giving up my career as an artist to go off to Washington and essentially be a bureaucrat.
But something changed your mind.
Well, they kept, in a gentle way, harassing me until I finally agreed to go to Washington. I had to be in Washington for another reason. I told them that while I was there, I would stop in and explain to them why I didn't think, I wanted the job. And I told them I'd be happy to give them my opinion as a working artist as to the sort of things that I would hope that the NEA would do. And you know how life is. One thing leads to another. And, a week or two later, I found myself as one of the candidates. But I was safe in my assumption that they would pick a better candidate than myself. But alas, no, I seem to have been the final nominee.
You talked about it as something of a risk to your career as a writer. Is that because you just have to stop writing poetry while you do something like that?
Well, I hope not quite to that extreme.
You'd have a hard time applying for a grant. You realize
exactly.
That.
Well, one of the actually the legal requirements of the job, because it's a high level presidential appointment, is that you really can't, write for money. And so, you know, at the moment...
That's perfect for a poet, isn't it?
Exactly. Well, the trouble is that, you know, that I, for the last 11 years, have been supporting my family as a writer. I mean, I write journalism, both about literature and about classical music. I do shows on American culture for BBC. I edit anthologies. I write essays. And I write poetry. I'm also, I think, a fairly active public intellectual. I'm in the speaking circuit a lot, talking about literature, talking about public culture. And so, in a funny way, that, you know, all of these things that I've worked so hard, in a sense, to cultivate these interesting kind of enterprises that I do as a writer, you know, are all going to have to be put aside. Though the one saving grace about this whole thing is that I'll actually be very much the way I used to be in business, where I'll work all day, and I hope that at night I'll be able to find some time where I can write poems without having to worry about where I'm publishing them or anything else, and you know, create a kind of meditative space in my own life where I can continue at least with the central thing that interests me as an artist, which is poetry.
But the one thing in that list of occupations that you have that you would not put aside would be that of public intellectual. As a matter of fact, you'd be perhaps an even more public intellectual in a position like that, no?
Well, I hope that I wouldn't check my intellect at the door. And I, you know, I guess I'm old-fashioned and idealistic enough to think that perhaps what one wants in a place like the NEA is somebody with a commitment, you know, towards public artistic life, public intellectual life.
Dana, there's a poem in your new collection called Interrogations at Noon. In fact, it is the title poem, which I think you did as a... specifically for the BBC originally?
Yeah, I was in England doing several BBC shows, and I was asked by Andrew Motion, who's the poet laureate of England, if I would write a poem that could be read on National Poetry Day in England. Now, what they had done is made an arrangement with the BBC that they would be reading poems on the air at specific times of day. And what I wanted was midnight, because I'm a night owl. I mean, I was actually working California time till 3 a.m. last night on an article that I'm going to be publishing in the Hudson Review. But I was informed by the poet laureate that they weren't going to broadcast as late as midnight. So I was able to compromise for noon. And they also wanted the poem to take place in a specific location so that they could essentially record it with a live background. And so what I chose was a poem to be, you know, as it were, about noon, to be read in an office building. And it's about that odd sinking feeling that one gets in the middle of the day that you're not really accomplishing all that you might. So it's to a certain degree, it's a poem of self incrimination.
Now
it's called.
I read it first this weekend in anticipation of this conversation about your trip to Washington, and of the poems, I thought to myself, now there's someone sitting at a desk who, you know, if the people who do sit at a desk could articulate as well as you do, this is perhaps what they would say. Am I so wrong in that interpretation?
Well, I think it's what they say on a bad day. It may be a very Catholic poem because it's, you know, it's very much about the examination of conscience, you know, about looking at your own life and mainly seeing the missed opportunities and the failures.
Why don't you read it to us?
Interrogations at Noon. Just before noon, I often hear a voice, cool and insistent, whispering in my head. It is the better man I might have been, who chronicles the life I've never led. He cannot understand what grim mistake granted me life, but left him still unborn. He views his wayward brother with regret, and hardly bothers to disguise his scorn. Who is the person you pretend to be? He asks. The failed saint, the simpering boor, the pale connoisseur of spent desire, the half-hearted hermit eyeing the door. You cultivate confusion like a rose, in watery lies too weak to be untrue, and play the minor figures in the pageant extravagant and empty, that is you.
That poem is called Interrogations at Noon. It read by the man who wrote it, Dana Gioia. It is the name of the most recent collection of poetry Dana's published. You obviously like to read out loud. I can hear it in your voice.
Well, for me, I've always thought of poetry as an auditory art. I mean, the way I was introduced to poetry was not in school, but by my mother, you know, who's not a woman of much formal education, who used to recite from memory or read from a couple of very cheap little pamphlets and anthologies that she had picked up along the way, poems that she loved. And so I'd always, you know, thought of poetry as a musical art. And so I write my poems as it were to be heard.
Sort of like grown-up nursery rhymes or nursery rhymes for grown-ups?
No, sort of like the way poetry has mostly been written through the ages. Although I love nursery rhymes because, you know, nursery rhymes in a way are wonderful ways of just finding out the noises that words can make when you put them together skillfully.
Let's go back. Go ahead, Dan.
Although we tend to study poems in books, that through most of human history, poetry has been seen as a kind of verbal equivalent of song. You know, the words may have been composed on the page, but they were composed in such a way as to be heard by a listener rather than seen by a reader. Now, in the 20th century, that begins to change when poetry becomes typographic and visual. But I think in the long view, the 20th century is a kind of interesting episode in a much longer history of poetry, largely as a spoken art. Because remember, poetry existed in culture and was all indeed perfected in culture before the invention of writing.
Your original essay, Can Poetry Matter, was published in 1992. It was republished in a collection of your essays in 2002, 10 years afterwards, and it comes with what's almost like a startled acknowledgement from you that, yes, in fact, it does matter, and it's become, it started to matter more and more to us. Is that accurate?
Well, yes. When I wrote the essay originally, it appeared in, you know, The Atlantic in 91, you know, it was never my assertion that poetry did not matter. You know, what I was doing in that essay was looking at what struck me as an interesting cultural paradox, that never in the history of humanity had any society invested so much money and effort in poetry as the United States did, which literally has created tens of thousands of jobs for people who profess poetry in institutions, which had prizes and grants and huge sections and libraries and things like that. And yet there never seemed to have been a culture in which the art of poetry mattered less to the average person. And by the average person, I don't mean a person of undistinguished mind or intellect. I mean, I'm talking about everything from lawyers and doctors and clergymen, you know, through working people. And so I said, well, how did this happen? And it did occur to me that maybe the very ways that America was, as it were, championing poetry, preserving poetry, teaching poetry, were in some ways inimical, contradictory to what most people needed from poetry. And so I gave a kind of critique of what struck me as the poetry establishment in the United States.
Now let me just stop you there, Dana, because we have to take a short break. But when we come back, I want you to tell us what you saw happening in the 10 years since you made that statement, rattled a few of the window panes in the ivory tower in the doing. Connection listeners, Dana Gioia is my guest. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston.
We're back. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And with me today, Dana Gioia, the poet, author of Interrogations at Noon, Daily Horoscope, The Gods of Winter, as well as a number of critical collections, translations, and other edited works. Dana Gioia is heading off to Washington tomorrow and will be considered as the next head of the NEA. We're talking about poetry. And Dana, when we just took our short break, you were wrapping up the what you'd said in Can Poetry Matter in 1991 and moving us ahead to today. Tell me what's changed.
Well, if I can go back to the actual publication of the article, something very interesting happened. When Can Poetry Matter appeared in Atlantic Monthly, it generated more mail, and this is in the pre-email days, than any article the Atlantic had ever published on any topic. Hundreds and hundreds of people wrote in giving their opinions on things. People in newspapers, on radio shows, even on television, began talking about the article. And I think what happened was that it created a kind of public conversation that about this piece. And I have to say that the piece was received overwhelmingly favorably. Most of the people that wrote in didn't complain about it. They agreed with it. And I think this was... The article was one of several things that was happening in American society at that point in which people outside of the university were insisting on their right, as it were, to be part of what public poetry was. And in the last 10 years, there's been an explosion of interest in poetry on a civic, local, and community level, as well as in the media. You now hear poems all the time on the radio. You hear them quoted on television, in movies. You see them quoted in newspapers. There's been hundreds of book festivals, poetry festivals created around the United States. You've got readings now, which used to be something that was largely done 20 years ago, only at college campuses, now in bookstores, bars, libraries, museums. And so you've, in a sense, seen the public sphere not only welcome, but enthusiastically demand that poetry comes back to it. And so it's now entering the lives of really millions of people who would not have characteristically seen it a quarter of a century ago. I mean, you can't even ride the bus or the subway nowadays without encountering a poem on your journey.
Or open the entertainment section in the newspaper where you'll see ads for things like Russell Simmons' Deaf Poetry Jam on Broadway. That's playing to enthusiastic audiences. In fact, we've got a short bit of a poem by the artist Georgia Mee. Let's listen to that.
Full-figured potential. A fat girl's blues. Out of money, looking for a snack. Then I see little Debbie's face on a pack. Smiling, enticing me, inviting me to have a taste. With haste, I race to the destruction of my waist. As the sugar sets in, so does the disgust I feel. Wishing I had the power of will, or hoping someone would kill this gluttonous monster, which rules my eyes, which is bigger than my stomach. So we fill my belly with pies and cakes, byproducts, additives, and other shit. It's hard for me to quit. Sweets are a quick hit. My diet includes fried everything, all kinds of pork. People asking if I've been visited by the stork.
That's Georgia Mee, a little bit of a poem that she does in the Russell Simmons Deaf Poetry Jam. Is that what you're talking about, that kind of sort of much more public presentation of poetry than we had 10 years ago, Dana?
Well, that's certainly part of it. I mean, if you said, well, what's the most unexpected and influential thing that's happened in American poetry over the last 20 years, it's been the recreation of popular poetry. Now, back when I was at Harvard in the early and mid-70s, it was an unquestioned assumption that popular poetry was dead forever, that poetry, to the degree it would exist in the future, was going to be a learned and elitist art practiced largely in the university. I could never accept that. I'm a working-class kid. I mean, I come from people who didn't go to college, a lot of people who didn't even weren't even raised speaking English. And it struck me that the average person may not like to read poetry, but they love to hear good poetry. And that one of the problems in our society was we had no way of, in a sense, making it accessible to them. And so what's happened in the last 10, 15 years is that a whole series of groups of people who were excluded from literary life, and this is everything from the inner city, African American, to cowboys, the agricultural workers, people like this, like I'm talking about cowboy poetry and rap here, obviously, they have come in and they've talked about their own life experience in poetry. And the poetry is not geared towards a literary audience. It's geared towards a mass audience. And they have not done their work within the official literary establishment. They've largely reached people through what we would think of as the popular entertainment world. And they have been rapturously received by the general public.
I do want to go to our calls, but one question before we do that, Dan, and that is why? What was being missed in 1992 that people are starting to figure out now?
I think that there is an assumption among literary academics in a way that they have to condescend when they speak to the general public. And I've always believed that it's fundamental that a writer respects the intelligence of all his or her readers, and that you speak to your readers as equals, not as a professor to a beginning student. But I also think that the way the average people think about poetry is radically different from the way a scholar does. A scholar, as it were, wants to talk about the whole oeuvre of a writer, how it works into the literary period, how it works into ideological and aesthetic arguments. That's interesting to some people, but not to the average person. What the average person wants is the individual poem that may touch their life. I think Garrison Keillor understands this beautifully. Writer's Almanac, which reads a poem a day without any commentary whatsoever, reaches, I think, millions of people who normally wouldn't hear poems, and they love it.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Boston. Sarah's waiting on the line. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was wondering if your guest could answer a few questions. I'm involved in another art form, ballet. I'm a soloist with Boston Ballet, which is not very considered very accessible to the general public. And being the head of the NEA is obviously going to be doing a lot more than poetry. And I was wondering, I know about 10 years ago, it was 62 cents or around there for the taxpayer to pay for the NEA every year, and I know that that number has gone down considerably, and I wanted to know what your guest thought about just support for the NEA in general and about other art forms other than poetry, and how he would try and support them or try and, I don't know.
Sarah, do you mean the political support for it, or do you mean public support for
the NEA? Well, both public and political, but obviously the politicians have cut down the funding, so even if you had public support, you'd have to have a huge referendum to try to up the money that was given to the NEA every year, and that obviously didn't happen.
Dana.
Well, I have to say that out of courtesy to the Senate, I have been asked not to talk about what my policies would be at the NEA until I meet with the various majority and minority leaders of the committee in the Senate. So I'm really not able to talk about that in an official capacity. Right now I'm just another working artist like you. I will say that, you know, I am a huge ballet fan. My wife and I went to the New York City Ballet for 20 years. We had subscriptions when we were in New York. There are 11 different disciplines that the NEA supports, you know, that range from dance and theater through broadcast and the visual arts, and that, you know, all of those things, you know, get equal treatment from the NEA. I would not have agreed to pursue this position if I didn't, really absolutely believe in the tremendous importance that the NEA has for not just American artists, but also just the American public. Because one of the nice things that one can do, you know, at the NEA is you can, as it were, help the public. You know, if you go back to the original vision of the NEA under Lyndon Baines Johnson when they created this, it had a very simple and I think inarguable purpose. The first was to foster excellence in the American arts, and the second was to increase the accessibility of the arts to the American people. And I think those are noble goals.
Oh, I agree with you entirely, and I would just like to ask you one last question. Theoretically, without making any breach of your agreement with the Senate, would you support more funding to the NEA? Would you like to ask for it?
I don't. The answer is of course, but I don't want to talk about this because I have been asked not to, and I've given my word that I will not talk about these issues in public until I do the courtesy of having the Senate, who is to confirm me, ask those questions to me and answer them to their satisfaction.
Can I ask you, Dan, it's Dick here, whether or not, and not to get into, you know, what the details of your own policy would be, but whether or not you think it's important that the government, that public money should go towards the support of art. I mean, we're listening to Deaf Poetry Jam and the way that the art can grow, has grown in certain areas, all of it with a little bit of public support here, public support there. Sometimes it's private money. Does that have to be there? Is that essential?
That's about three or four questions and wrapped up together.
Guilty.
Yeah, once again, I don't want to talk about these topics. I mean, you know, but I would say the answer is yes, yes, and no.
Which was the no?
The does it have to be there? Well, you know, I think the arts are tough, and I think they'll survive no matter what anyone does to them. But, you know, that the government, you know, I think has decided many years ago that it was appropriate to support the arts. And I think that most of American public and certainly most American artists agree with that.
Right.
Myself included.
1-800.
As both a citizen and as an artist.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Sarah, thanks for your call to Worcester. Now Victor's on the line. Hi, Victor.
Hi.
Oh, hello? Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Victor. I'm a poet and literary critic. I've written for periodicals all over the country. And I just really want to say just how fond I am of your guest today. I am not familiar with his work. I won't pretend to be. But the things he's been saying are things I've been saying in print and loudly for more than a decade. And I'm very, very thankful that there's somebody out there that is at least acknowledging the contributions of poets that are working from a street level up, as opposed to from the confines of academia's ivory tower, if you will. Are you there?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry. It sounds like static here. I just really, I don't know. And this is maybe kind of a broad, abstract sort of question. But do you really get the feeling that the poetry that when it was centralized more in academia, really disconnected from the common people that much? Did it really have that feeling of poets weren't writing for real people? They were just sort of writing for within the confines of this academic machine?
Dana?
Well, you know, Victor, I think that you've asked two really good questions or raised two really important topics, and I want to address them both. The first one is the acknowledgement that you're making as a working artist, working literary artist, poet and critic, who works outside of the academy, that you too are part of American culture, part of American literature. And I think one of the things that's upset me so much over the years is that this assumption in American intellectual life that all worthwhile artistic and intellectual activity happens only within the official institutions. I mean, I know that poetry is something that is an art form practiced by, I would guess at this point, millions of people in the United States. And indeed, there are some tremendously important, talented poet and critics who have no academic appointment whatsoever. If you go back to the modernist era, and you look at the age of T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, Marion Moore, E.E. Cummings, Robert Frost. If you took the 10 leading modernists, only one of them was an academic. And the other people were everything from Wallace Stevens, who worked in insurance, to Ezra Pound, who was a bohemian, T.S. Eliot, who worked in publishing and was also a banker. Even Robert Frost, the one academic, spent a great deal of his life as a chicken farmer. And I think that this variety of life experience of seeing American society, seeing life itself from different perspectives, enriched and enlarged American literature. And so I feel that it is very important when we talk about American culture, not simply to be talking about American cultural institutions. Now, the other thing that you're asking is whether the kind of poetry that is written in the university doesn't meet the needs of people. And I would say yes and no. I mean, there is tremendously good work being done in all of the arts inside the university. And there's also mediocre work and terrible work being done inside the university. It's like everything else. It's a very mixed bag. My issue was more that there's something about institutions, especially English departments, that tends to be insular. They're more interested in a sense of talking among themselves than they are in a sense reaching out to the communities. And you see this all the time, that, you know, that what's going on at a university, the people that attend these things are entirely from within the university, especially in literature programs and things like that. And so that all of the cultural energy, all of the creativity that's happening inside universities is not sufficiently being part of a general society. And, you know, what I was hoping, would happen, as it were, there would be more, as it were, conversation between the institutions that support culture and the American people at large. But the most important thing that's happened in American poetry over the last 10 years has been that people like you, Victor, have become publicly involved in the art, bringing different perspectives in, bringing new work in, enlarging, as it were, both the creativity and the reception of literature.
Now, Dana, it's been about 10 years, is it not, since you started working full-time as a writer?
I've been a full-time writer 11 years. Now, but I have to say, some people have this notion that I was a business executive, and then one day I just said, I'm going to quit and be a poet. No, every night for 17 years that I was in business, I went home and I spent 2-3 hours reading and writing. I did it every weekend. And while I was in business, I was publishing in The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Nation, The Hudson Review. But 11 years ago, largely because of some things that had happened in my own life, most importantly, the death of my first son, I decided to quit and become a full-time writer.
So, Connection listeners, you can do it both ways, either with one job or completely as a writer. My guest is Dana Gioia. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is the poet Dana Gioia. And Dana, you were just saying that back in 1991, your shift to full-time writing coincided with the death of your first child, Michael Jasper, who was just months old at the time. Am I right?
Yeah, he died at 4 months suddenly of you know, what used to be called crib death. Now it's called sudden infant death syndrome. And he was our only child at that point. And, you know, when something like that happens in your life, it burns through your life like a wildfire. And there's very little left standing. And when as my wife and I, a year later, were coming out of just the paralyzing grief that caused, I mean, I realized that the things that mattered to me were my family, my writing, and my spiritual life, that my job didn't matter, that money didn't matter. And, you know, it seemed to me that, you know, if I was going to really do what I wanted in life, that, you know, I should focus on the things that mattered. And so about a year later, after our second son was born, you know, I just went into my boss's office and resigned.
We actually have.
And since then, I've been sort of living as a working writer, largely writing prose. I review music. I write about literature. Write for the theater. So I'm actively involved in really probably three different arts.
One of our connection callers from Columbia, South Carolina, is actually interested in a poem that you wrote about that. Mark's joining us now. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
You were calling in about the poem, The Gods of Winter.
Well, yes. Yes, I was. I just think it's a beautiful poem. I first came across your writing, Mr. Ajoya, in that essay, Can Poetry Matter? And then I started looking around for other writing of yours. And then when your book came out, The Gods of Winter, the title poem, I just fell in love with it. I teach writing at a small community college here in Columbia, South Carolina, and I often teach this poem, fathers and sons, and of course death. But there's a stanza in it, if I may. It's just so beautiful. I have a son myself, and I love him dearly. I have two daughters as well, and the love you feel is just very deep. May I, the one stanza?
Do you want to read it? Or I know. Is it the second stanza?
Yes, the second.
I think I know this one by heart, the second stanza, which is I'm describing looking at some cut flowers in the window during a snowstorm back east, and how, you know, when flowers are cut, they're still heliotropic. They still sort of move towards the sun. And I start to use this as a metaphor in a sense of this life. And I think it goes like this. You can, briefest of joys, our life together. This brittle flower twisting toward the light, even as it dies. No more permanent for being perfect. Time will melt away triumphant winter, and even your touch prove the ephemeral jewel of ice. I think that's the way it goes, something like that, doesn't it?
The unpossessable jewel of ice.
Okay, the unpossessable jewel of ice.
That's so beautiful.
Thank you very much. I'm glad you have the text there, because I didn't bring that book with me, so I just was doing it from memory.
I also want to thank you for the excellent textbook that you've been editing with X.J. Kennedy, the Introduction to Literature, Fiction, Poetry, and Drama. I use that as well. It's a very, very sound book. Glad to hear of your nomination. You have my vote, sir.
Well, thank you very much.
Mark, let me ask you before you go, though, as a teacher at a college, whether or not the thesis that's been pushed by Dana from Can Poetry Matter through the past 10 years, that we need to make poetry more accessible, more about the readers, less about the ivory tower and the professors and the editors.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. I consider myself an exception that tests the rule. I try to be as unacademic and academic as I can be. My family comes first in the life I live with them, and I try to bring that life and love into the classroom, and it works sometimes, not all the time, of course, but that's my philosophy of being a teacher. It's part of my love of life, the joy of poetry, and I try to bring that to the classroom and say, don't worry if you don't understand this Wallace Stevens poem. We're going to hear the music first. If you begin to hear the music, the poetry will come. The poetry will come. The poetry is the music. And some of them hear it and respond to it. Not all. But the few that do are great successes. So anyhow, good luck to you, Mr. Joy. I'm looking forward to seeing what you're going to do with the NEA. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, I mean, if I can just say something here, I think Mark is so right, is that, you know, poetry has tended to be taught as if it's some kind of complicated analytical speech. And so a poem is this verbal object that we then analyze in conceptual terms. And I think that's a misconception. Poetry is a special way of speaking that was developed way back at the origins of humanity. It is a special way of using language that invites and rewards a special way of hearing. And it addresses the fullness of our humanity, not just the intellect, but the emotions, the imagination, the intuition, the physical body through both the sound of the words and the images, and also the memory. You know, poetry requires, as it were, this involvement from the listener, where the listener, as it were, completes the poem. And so I think that what we're trying to do when we're teaching poetry is first and foremost not to teach people how to analyze it, but how to experience it, how to get them to listen to language in the fullness of their own humanity.
I hear in your description some of your ideas as a poet, because in your poems, in some of your poems, I read this observation of the world that you have, that just because you don't write about something doesn't mean it isn't beautiful. It is anyway. You know, the world goes on, even if someone can't find the word to mark it as it passes. You know what I mean? Let's go to line to Framingham, Massachusetts, and Peter's joining us. Hi, Peter.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Yes. I realize he cannot comment on, you know, what he might do, you know, if he gets the job, which I am not against it at the moment. But I'm wondering if he can discuss what he sees is the role of arts in general. Specifically, that while, of course, I agree that art should speak to everyone, sometimes I think that art should also challenge the public, tell them things they don't necessarily want to hear, or show them things they don't necessarily want to see, and whether he sees that as a necessary part of the arts.
I think it's an interesting question. I think you're absolutely right, Peter, that the difference between art and, if I might say, mere entertainment is that entertainment, you sort of know what you're going to get. It gives you an experience, and you leave that experience pretty much the same person who entered it. Where in art, I think there is almost always a small or a large experience of transformation that goes on. In the process of engaging with the poem, with the play, with the painting, with the piece of music, in some ways enlarges your humanity or transforms your humanity. And that goes really to the basic purpose of the arts. I mean, the arts exist. Each art, in a certain way, focuses on a different set of senses. I mean, it could be sight in painting, it could be sound in music, it could be combinations of those in various forms of theater. But what art does is, in a sense, bring us to the full potential of our humanity. It enlarges our sympathies with the world, our sense of ourself, and it wakes us up, it alerts us, it enlivens us. And there's different ways of being, you know, sometimes you can be awoken pleasurably, sometimes you're awoken with shock. And so I think I wouldn't say that all art should shock, in the same way that I wouldn't think that all art should be pleasant and cheerful. Art should be as broad and as capacious as human experience.
Peter, thanks for your call. And Dana, I'm wondering if I can get you to flip open your Interrogations at Noon to the Summer Storm poem. Perhaps just tell us if there's a story behind it and maybe give us a chance to hear it.
Well, you know, one of the things I've been interested in doing as a poet is not only reviving some of the older forms of poetry, but also telling stories in poems. I mean, poetry for thousands of years told stories. Then when modernism came around, we were told that, well, you know, storytelling is what prose does. But I think that there's certain stories that can only be told as poems because there's a kind of mystery about them. And this is a poem that begins at a wedding, and it's called Summer Storm. We stood on the rented patio while the party went on inside. You knew the groom from college. I was a friend of the bride. We hugged the brownstone wall behind us to keep our dress clothes dry and watched the sudden summer storm floodlit against the sky. The rain was like a waterfall of brilliant beaded light. Cool and silent as the stars, the storm hid from the night. To my surprise, you took my arm, a gesture you didn't explain, and we spoke in whispers as if we too might imitate the rain. Then suddenly the storm receded as swiftly as it came. The doors behind us opened up. The hostess called your name. I watched you merge into the crowd, aloof and yet polite. We didn't speak another word, except to say good night. Why does that evening's memory return with this night's storm. A party 20 years ago, its disappointments warm. There are so many might-have-beens, what-ifs that won't stay buried. Other cities, other jobs, strangers we might have married. And memory insists on pining for places it never went, as if life might be happier just by being different.
The poem is Summer Storm, read by the man who wrote it, Dana Gioia. Do you look back a lot and think about the way things might have been?
Oh, inevitably. I think that there's a, so much of what one does in life is lead it retrospectively, don't you? I mean, memory seems to me to be the great matrix of the arts. I mean, actually, if you go back to Greek mythology, memory is the mother of the muses.
And yet in one of your essays, Business and Poetry, you talk about the artist needing time to think, time to read, time for idle but intelligent conversation. I hope you have time for all of those. I'm not sure that you do or you will.
Well, that remains to be seen. I mean, I will have to give up all of my editing, my broadcast work, my criticism, my music reviewing in this new job. But I hope not to give up poetry. And in fact, it may be a blessing in disguise by, in a sense, getting rid of all the things that I've had to do over the last 11 years to make a living. Maybe I'll have a little bit more of that meditative space late in the evening to return to my roots as a poet.
Well, best wishes when you face the senators.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Dana Gioia, poet, critic, translator, nominee to head the National Endowment for the Arts. Just a programming note, a welcome to our new listeners at KWMU in St. Louis, Missouri, and WRKF in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Connection listeners, you can find some more of Dana Gioia's poems and continue the conversation about public and public poetry online. You can find us at our forum pages. Our website is theconnection.org. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. Coming up on Here and Now, the latest news and a